How many of you would say that you are a fan of some team or sport? You follow some activity, you watch, you cheer, you might even have some branded clothing. I've got a best friend who has perfected the subtle art of celebrating my birthday, which is really him just mocking me. And so he took me out for my birthday, and to my great surprise, a bunch of friends were there. We were at an ice rink, because my sport is figure skating, and it is a sport and an art form at the same time. We get to this ice rink, and we're all laced up, and we're on the ice, and then we get there, and so my friends turn all at once, and they look at me, and they say, "Okay, go ahead." And I realize that they think that because I watch figure skating, that I can figure skate. Keep in mind, I am hanging on for dear life to the sides of the walls. I am not built for ice skating. And as they realize that I can't do anything, they start taking off, they're laughing. And as they each pass me by, I start like whirling out like, "Well, you watch basketball and you can't play basketball. And well, you watch cooking shows and you can't." Well, you know, it's a weird niche, right? It's sort of, why would anyone watch figure skating unless you had a personal history with it? In the same way, it feels like Esther is throwing this question into our face of, why would you call yourself a Christian? Why would you say that you follow God if all you do is spectate? So let me ask you a couple questions just to get us started. What would your faith look like if you never actually trusted God in your everyday, real life moments? What would it look like? What does it look like when God offers you defining moments in your relationship with Him? And what would it look like if you missed those moments? These are the questions I've been struggling with through this whole book. This is the question for this chapter that just zeroes right in. So let's get started. To refresh your memory, we are at a place where this evil guy named Haman has picked a fight with his blood feud to the Jews. He's offered the king a lot of money. By today's standards, about $3.5 billion, adjusting for inflation. That's about two-thirds of the annual income that the king gets in a year. He's offered this blood money as saying, "Let me, you know, there's a bunch of people who are really dangerous to you, king. Let me just take care of them." King says, "Sure, great idea." So now Mordecai and Esther, the Jews, are in deep trouble. And we pick it up in chapter 4. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth and ashes, and he went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. The first thing I want to note is what that must have felt like. To hear the news and your immediate response be one of such sorrow that you change your clothing. You go out into the streets and you cry out aloud. And you're not alone. You're not a weirdo on the street. Your neighbor is there. The person across the street is there. Everyone who follows God is doing the same thing. And I wonder, man, I wonder if there is an opportunity. I mean, I don't know what that looks like. What does that look like today? If we were to lament corporately together. What if all of a sudden, like, word comes out through the pathways, emails, and the phone chains, and the text chains, like, "Hey, there's a small group that's fasting and praying and crying out, and they invite the rest of us because there's someone in deep crisis." We don't fast much, or at least I don't know many people who do, and certainly as a church, we don't. You don't hear the pastor saying, "By the way, we're starting a fast," etc. I mean, we are. The students of Pathways and the IBBW, we're going to fast together, and we invite you, Pathways, to join us when that happens. We'll give you more details when that happens. But I wonder if we're missing an opportunity to corporately lament and cry out to God. By the way of which, this whole God is missing from the Bible thing, why would you fast and wail and not cry out to God? It's like the author had to work really hard to leave God's name out of that. Like, oh, maybe they're just fasting because they're dieting in their crisis. It doesn't make any sense. Like, you have to work really hard to leave God out of this passage. Because there is something in our chaos, in our strife, in our crises, something in us cries out to God. No matter whether you are a follower of God or not, something in every human cries out for a greater being when you are in trouble. We continue in verse 4. When Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. And then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. When I first read this, I couldn't figure out what Esther's motivation was. And my first thought was, well, I mean, she's not really much more than a teenager. I don't think she really understands what's going on. I mean, keep in mind, she's in isolation. She's just with the other women who are with the king. She's not connected to her community anymore. She doesn't get global news reports. Esther only had a limited amount of time to train her, to teach her, to raise her up. I wonder if, in the same way, we need to face a lot of questions about what our student general population, what our college, what our 20s don't really understand about the way in which we practice our faith. Why is there such a giant chasm of operational discord between student ministries and college ministries and adult ministries? And why are there huge cracks? And I wonder if there's something about the way that we need to raise up our... I mean, I'm the student ministry pastor. This is kind of on me, right? But I wrestle with these questions. I don't know how many students we graduate from high school who are like, yes, finally I get to go to the adult service. We don't see the enthusiasm. There is something that we as adults need to be flexible about. There's something that we need to give them charges for. There is something. I think in this situation, Mordecai and the Jews are crying out, and Esther is like, well, you should put on some clothes. I don't think she gets it. To be fair. All right, I'm going to stand over here because as much study as I've done, and as much, there are some things that I know, and when I know them, I'll stand there. But when I'm taking a guess, I'll stand here. So that was my first guess as to what Esther was thinking. I later found out that was not the case. She can't talk to Mordecai if he's in sackcloth and ashes because of the royal protocol. He's got to be wearing appropriate attire to be inside the palace, and so therefore she can't talk to him. So she wants to talk to him, so she sends him clothes. Makes sense? But as a student pastor, my first thought was, well, she doesn't know what's going on. All right, verse 6. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to instruct her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. In other words, Mordecai picks up a pen and tells his adopted daughter, hey, listen, I know I've told you for the past 5 years to kind of hide your faith. I know I've kind of told you to just kind of live according to culture. But now I need you to risk everything, including your life, please, for the rest of us. Thanks. There is no mention that he had been preparing her for some kind of big moment. There is no mention that he had been raising her up to, like, hey, wait for the code word. It'll be needed. Like, hide this until we're ready. Plan, we're going to launch the plan. There is no mention of anything. He just said, you need to survive. Don't tell anyone you're a Jew. But now, all of a sudden, remember, she has no idea. This comes at her just out of nowhere. And he's going to tell her, hey, I need you to do this thing, and it's going to cost you everything. For those of you who are parents or have parents, this is a huge ask. This is a parenting style that we would not recommend. This is a challenge of faith to your child that this is everything. This is the whole ballgame. I find this anathema to the way that we raise our kids. I find this so hard as a parent myself to say, like, as a stepfather, I have trouble asking my children to do, like, hey, are you in a bad mood because I really need you to do your chores? Like, it's hard for me to broach, like, their bad mood, to come out of nowhere and say, hey, by the way, risk everything you have and do this thing for God, whom you haven't worshipped in 5 years. Do this thing for the people of God, whom you haven't been connected to forever. Do this incredibly bold and brave thing. Refine this connection real fast. This is a hard challenge. I wonder if God, our parent, often does the same thing to you. I wonder if God gives you opportunities out of left field and says, hey, do this big thing. And you just have to trust. Verse 9. Hathach, the eunuch, he goes back and reports to Esther what Mordecai had said. And then she instructs back to Mordecai. And she says this. She says, most honored father, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law. They're going to be put to death. Unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their lives. And maybe you didn't know this, father, but 30 days have passed since I was called to go into the king. Let's read between the lines. Put your own child, or maybe imagine that you have a child. What are you hear her saying? Thank you for thinking of me, Dad. No. And by the way, I can't. I'm so sorry. It's just coincidence, Dad. I can't help it. I can't go because he would put me to death because I haven't been summoned yet. And it just happens that, it's been a long time. So I don't think he's going to call me back. And so this is just not going to work. Sorry, Daddy. By the way, she hasn't seen the king in a month. Why? Remember, this is 5 years later. This is 5 years after she was taken. Xerxes has done another roundup. She's been queen for 5 years, and he decided to do it again. So he's got another couple hundred, 1,000 young women running through his harem. She hasn't seen him in a month. We're going to make some assumptions based on some research here. It's time to be completely authentic about the Bible. If you were to look up in secular historical books, Queen Esther of Persia, you're not going to find her. You will find a guy named Marduka who sounds an awful lot like Mordecai in what was accomplished and what was done. But it's a weird thing that the queen wouldn't have seen the king for 30 days. we think. We think Esther wasn't really the official royal queen that goes in the history books. We think she was first concubine. We think she was, in Chinese language, we call her, she's not the Tai, she's not the big wife. She's like the second wife or the favorite wife of the moment. So in every way, in the household, she is queen, but not in the official annals. I only mention this to tell you how much she has at risk. Think about this. She is fighting inside the royal court, political intrigue, power moves, eunuchs trying to use her, abuse her, politically manipulate her. There is a lot of money being thrown around. There are young women vying for her position. She is trying to get time with the king to solidify her position, but to do that is to do some sexual things that she didn't want to do. There is all sorts of chaos going on. She has nothing that she can really bank on. There is no stability in Esther's life. And this message from her beloved father comes, and he says, by the way, risk it all. This is an incredibly huge challenge for Esther. Verse 12. When Mordecai received his daughter's reply, he sent back this answer. Daughter, do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows? And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. Ah, finally! Finally, our hero Mordecai has stepped forward. This is not the Mordecai of chapter 1, 2, and 3. This is not the guy who just let his daughter go. This is not the one who told her to hide her faith. This is not the one who told her to eat whatever was put in front of her. This is not the one who did this and this, do this. This is all of a sudden Mordecai is all in on his faith. Like something about that blood feud really just, and now he's revealing who he really is. He's been hiding all this time or something, but the book, the text, Mordecai's been hiding from us. In that verse, he reveals so much depth of theological wisdom. There is no way he said those sentences without being a deep scholar of Old Testament Torah. In those few sentences, he reveals a deep understanding of history that God's purposes on the grand scale cannot be denied. And that God will take care of his people somehow. He knows the Old Testament story of Genesis and Exodus and the patriarchs. He knows of the constant attacks on the enemy. He knows of God's constant delivery. Mordecai also understands that God invites individuals into key moments to partner with him. And furthermore, Mordecai also understands that there are personal costs for those who choose not to obey God. He's familiar with the history of how Moses didn't get to enter the promised land. He's familiar with King Saul and his failure, and on, he knows his scripture. But who knows, Esther, but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. Every time I've heard this passage preached, I've had this thought of, oh good, doesn't apply to me. I'm not royal. This is a great story, God, thanks. I don't have to do anything. Except there's this other verse later on in scripture. It's in 1 Peter. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. You, by God's grace, are royal. You, by God's adoption, are royal. You, sitting here today, reading Esther's book of royal position, that applies to us. Pastor Jonathan, okay, I hear what you're saying there, but I'm looking at my life, and I don't see any crisis in my life, because I'm really doing pretty well here, and I don't really have a critical choice to be made, so, you know, what are you talking about? Let me look at this. This is cool. This verse just happens to be in the middle of the book. This verse just happens to be the turning point of the entire historical moment. This book is like a neon flashing light. This verse in the middle is God is like, this is the book of evangelism that I'm using, and this is the verse in the middle of it, and here's what I want you to see and do. And there's a theological term called descriptive or prescriptive, and when it's got this many flashing yellow signs, coincidentally, it is not descriptive. It's not just describing what happened to Esther and Mordecai. Well, that's for them, it's not for you. The very structure of the book is saying this verse is prescriptive. You have to do something about this. So what? What, God, is the challenge in front of us? What, God, is the challenge in front of me? If I can't see it, what am I not seeing? It's a little, we might say Mordecai and Esther had it a little easier. At least the threat was written down. It was right there. But come on. What Christian in America today would say that our faith is not under attack? Which one of us sitting here would not say that we face temptation to kind of water it down, to kind of give in? None of us are in sackcloth and ashes, and some of us are in that kind of trouble. What is the challenge in front of us? What is your answer going to be? We can take our cue from Esther. I love this. This is every youth pastor's favorite verse. Here we go, chapter 4, verse 15. Esther replies back to her father after this thing where she's trying to say, thank you, Dad, I can't do it. He says, oh, yes, you are. And by the way, you have to do this. I want to see, I wish I was there. I want to see Esther, this young woman. She reads her father's reply, her adopted father's reply, and something in her stands up. And something in her matches Mordecai's faith. And she says, all of a sudden, now she's giving directions. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, which is a different kind of fast than usual. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Look at this young woman. She has no reason to do what she's about to do. You think about what she's lost in her life. She was orphaned, and then her adopted family and her friends were taken away. Her way of life, her culture was eliminated from her. She has no touchstones. She's in a strange place with strange people who want her to do evil, horrible things. And it's not safe there either. She's constantly being manipulated and constantly being pressured and Furthermore, she has enough faith training to know that she's way outside of Torah law. She's way outside of God's blessings. And there's all these hundreds of young women trying to take her spot. And if you caught that line, go back to Mordecai's verse in 14. One more. He throws in a phrase that caught me. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. If you remain silent at this time, it'll come from another place, salvation. And I imagine as Mordecai was arriving, he had to pause. You and your father's family will perish. Remember, Mordecai's her adopted father. I'm I'm casting my own relationship with my own daughter and with my students into this relationship. But I try very hard not to point to my daughter that I'm not her actual father. And Mordecai pulls out all the stops and says, remember, you were the last of your line. You felt alone, now you're really going to feel alone because I'm not even with you in this. If you don't do this, your line is finished. In this moment with Esther, I mean, say what you will about the chapters up till now. Say what you will about the kind of flaws she has and what she did and didn't do and what she didn't stand up for and what she gave into. Say what you will. In this moment of challenge, this moment of God opening up and pausing the cosmos to wait on his beautiful daughter, and Esther says, I will do this. In this moment, I find Esther incredible. In this moment, she leaves her flawed faith behind her and she accepts that God is offering her another chance. In this moment, she chooses to reconnect with God in deep discipline. In this moment, she cries out for the community of God to help her in the same way that she is seeking God. In this moment, she resolves herself to take the risk. And in this moment, her story changes completely. So what does that mean for us? It means we have to find our own challenge. If this is the book that God has put in front of us, and it's a book of evangelism, and it's a book of God's blessings where we can't see it, but we can see it. If it's the book of God saving his people and saving a person, if it's a book for then, it's also a book for now, it's a book for us, it's a book for you, it's a book for me, it's a book for God saying, it's not different. There is a challenge in front of you. There is an opportunity in front of you. I am asking you to take this risk. I am asking you to take this step forward. I am asking you to join me in my plan for salvation. I can't tell you what your challenge is. So I put some questions in the YouVersion app. I put some questions. I'll email them to you later on. And if I put some questions, if you're not on that email list, if you just refuse to use the YouVersion app, well then fine, we made you a QR code. You can grab them that way. This is gonna be one of those really hard, awkward meditational or conversational moments between you and your friend, whoever you're, or your spouse. I'm not looking forward to mine with my wife because she's gonna ask me all these really pointed questions that I don't really wanna answer. Because I write these questions for your benefit. Do you feel a little uneasy right now? That's what I was aiming for. Because that's where Mordecai is. That's where Esther is. They don't know what's going to happen next. They don't know what the risk is going to, they don't know how it's going to turn out. Perhaps God will have some reassurance for us next week in the coming chapters. But I didn't want to leave without tracing some of these coincidences that have been running through the whole book. In chapter 4, we don't have time, but notably, there's a whole bunch of coincidences surrounding this whole communication pattern of how and why and who knows that Esther is or isn't a Jew. There's a lot of coincidences around there, and it just all happens to be, it all just kind of falls in line for this moment to happen. There's a lot of coincidences around Hathach, her chosen eunuch, and how, by the way, there was a whole lot of verses about how much Mordecai had to explain to Hathach. It's not because Hathach isn't going to get it. We think that though Esther was skilled in many ways, as a Persian woman are, we think she can't read. And so Mordecai had to use a messenger, and so the messenger had to get it right, and the messenger was able to read, and so the messenger had to explain to Esther, and so she's doing all of this, trusting that this translation, there's a whole bunch of coincidences going on around Hathach. But the biggest coincidence is this. Look at this one. It goes back to chapter 3. Haman's edict for the destruction of the Jews, it goes out on the 13th day of the first month. And all the Jews in the room went, oh. It's a little bit like saying to Christians, the threat goes out on December 24th. Every good Jew would recognize that day as Passover Eve. You remember Passover from Exodus, when the people of God were under oppression and threat, and God sent his angel to provide support and deliverance. And I wonder if maybe, just maybe in Esther's time, on this same exact day, whether God is going to offer deliverance again. Coincidence. We'll end with this. This is one of my favorite verses ever. I was going to include it at my wedding and I forgot, so I'm going to do it now. Jeremiah 6:16. Stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. Let me pray for you. I don't like this part of the book, God. I like reading about how coincidences happen and how you're here and how you're there and what's going on, but I don't like when you turn your gaze on me. And I don't like when your scripture starts to imply that I have opportunities that I'm not taking, and that maybe there are things I should be doing, and maybe, just maybe, you want more from me, you want more from us. The Asian-ness in me, God, feels really guilty about that, and I'm really trying hard not to pitch it as guilty, but as opportunity. Esther could have let this go by. She could have been fine in the palace and just writing her days. God would have delivered, you would have delivered the Jews a different way, God. Whatever this challenge is that's in front of me, if I miss it, then I know that I'm the only one who's going to lose out. You are the sovereign God, and your plans cannot be changed. But you are the loving God, and you invite us into this royal priesthood of partnership, this privilege. And Father, I think it's going to yield a whole bunch more praises on the other side. I think it's going to yield a whole bunch more intimacy on the other side. I think it's going to do things in my life, in our life, that make us different, that make us strong, that make us close, that make your name great among us. I think it's going to bring life. I think it's going to bring vitality. I want to ride this river that you've got us on. And yet, man, I'm so hesitant. I'm so afraid of what this is going to cost. And so we look to your word for reassurance. We look to these worship songs for your promises of faithfulness. We look to each other to speak truth into our lives, to give counsel of godliness, to give counsel of trusting you. We look to each other to be supportive when we need help. We lay at this altar our sacrifice of what we're hesitant to share, or we're hesitant to risk. These stupid baggage things that we carry around that are nowhere near as valuable as trusting you, as releasing it to you. My sense of economy is all wrong, and I hold on to the things I don't want, and I don't take what you offer, which is what I do want. Father, for everyone here looking at their life, would you reveal it? Would you open the clouds? Would you open the windows? Would you write our story like the way that you did? It just seems so obvious in this book. I want you to be so obvious in my life. I can't wait to see what you're going to do next with Esther and Mordecai, and I can't wait to see what you're going to do next in my life and our life, God. We pray for pathways, for whatever you have for us. Individually and corporately, we trust you. And all the people of God said, amen.